there is a land. A place in space-time, light years away. Where the best in progressive music of all types, rock, metal, electronic, and more, come together. It's time for you to take a journey to that magical realm where galaxies collide, the strangest of creatures lurk and slither, and rituals are enacted to bring about the dawning of a new age.
Introductions like that are why we can't have nice things. Folks, this is Progtopia, episode 133. And warm greetings to all of you in the land of Progtopia. Welcome to the program that features interviews, reviews, and discussions about both well-known and up-and-coming acts in prog, a term we sometimes define loosely and proudly so. My name is Mark Ashby, and I'm the host of the show. Join us now for a trip through the wires, and hopefully you'll come out the other side ready to subscribe to the program and follow it on Facebook and Twitter. Visit progtopia.com for past episodes and hear what you may have missed. For now, though, we press onward. Got a few things for you this time around, including a discussion with one of the deans of music journalism, Anil Prasad of Innerviews, regarding music streaming and how it's not so slowly or subtly ruining artists' chances to earn anything resembling a return on investment, let alone a living, for their hard work. Followed by an example of a band who's strategizing to work within that system. It's one we've profiled before, actually. But first, our usual artist interview. Many episodes ago, episode 093, to be exact, I guess that's not all that many episodes ago, we featured on this program a band out of the UK called the Rube Goldberg Machine. One of their members who spoke on that program was Jordan Brown, who is primarily a bassist by trade. So it was with some surprise that I learned that Jordan had composed an entire album on keyboards, but this is not your typical 2018 synthesizer album. For reasons you'll hear in the interview that follows, Jordan wanted to recreate the sound of 80s analog synths with a specific feeling in mind. Thus, under the name Nostromo from the Alien films, as I was reminded, Bad Elephant Music has released Synchestral Works Volume 1. And if you grew up with or are otherwise a fan of those fat keyboard patches from that time period, you'll probably love this album. Jordan and I talked about the inspirations for creating this music, the process in making newer instruments and technologies sound vintage, and whether this music is finding its intended audience. That's all coming up right now, so join me. Won't you please? This album is not exactly what I would have expected from you, knowing of your other work with the Rube Goldberg Machine and gigging around as a bassist in various genres. So what was the impetus for it?
It just happened. You know, I was the first song that I worked on, which is also the first song on the album, which is Experiment 85, was just an experiment. You know, I was just messing about with synthesizers because I was at that point in time, I was watching Stranger Things on Netflix.
Okay.
Which is this TV show. It's kind of like it's made to look and sound like those big productions from the 80s, like, you know, Spielberg.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of vibe, you know, kind of Indiana Jones or the Goonies or, you know, that kind of stuff. And the music reflects that kind of vibe. So it's all synthesizers. It's all like, you know, the good stuff, like in the '80s, you know, the golden age of composers who started to set out and discover what synthesizers could do.
Right.
So I'm like, oh, that's interesting. And then it just remained there. And then I just started playing around with ideas. And, you know, sooner than I knew, I had 8 songs. It just came out. I don't know. It just came out of me.
Well, had you ever written anything like that before?
No, not really. Tell you what's interesting. It's interesting how the vocabulary for that was so deeply entrenched in my culture as a musician. Not because I've ever done that, but just because, you know, as a 70s kid, I grew up with all the good stuff, you know, RoboCop and, you know, Close Encounters and Tron and all the cool movies of the era. It just so happened.
Well, you're speaking my language because Tron's one of my favorite movies of all time. So
isn't it great?
Yeah, it's. I wish they would make that third one. They've talked about it, but you know, I guess it's all about whether they think it'll make enough money or not. But
that always seems to be the case.
It does.
It's funny you should say that. But Tron, as a kid, I had a VHS with it, and I watched it every day for like 6 months.
I probably did the same at some point. Yeah. Well, this is a Bad Elephant Music release.
That is correct.
And regular listeners of this show will know that Bad Elephant's boss, David Elliott, is part of our semi-regular Prog Squad segments when we can get together and do them. I'm curious, what did he say to the idea of this release, if I might ask?
He was very positive about it, you know, and that's what I like about him. He's such a nice man. He's, you know, he just puts up with everything we throw at him. And it's really interesting because, I mean, as seen from his point of view, I just sent him a message on Facebook saying, "Would you be interested in this?" And he's like, "Yeah." And so it happened, you know, and the album is out, and I am really very happy about it.
Well, yeah, good call, David. That's what I have to say about it. It's pretty authentically analog sounding. It sounds like, you know, like you're saying, it's like this circa 1983, 1984 synthesizers. So what was the instrumentation and the process that you used on it?
Well, unfortunately, I am poor because I'm a musician, so
course,
I don't have
right.
the real synthesizers.
Right.
But what I did, I work in Cubase or Studio One or Ableton or whatever it is that I use at that moment in time. Mm-hmm. And you can get a number of synthesizers that can do the trick, but they don't sound like the real thing because they're too nice. Mm-hmm. So I went, you know, nice sounding, you know, because they're digital,
right, they're
in a software. So everything sounds pristine and, you know, very, very high, you know, high definition.
Right.
So I went back and went to research the signal chains from the era, you know, the Neve preamps and, or I don't know what kind of tape they used to do that, what kind of preamps, what kind of console, what kind of compressors they used to do that. And then I deliberately distorted, like saturated the sound so that it sounds old. You know, and with all the idiosyncrasies of the case, you know, just recording a signal on tape too hot so it distorts and it becomes more soft in a way or more, I don't know, sparkly. It's all that stuff, you know, and everything is kind of like handmade. You know, even though in this case, I use Cubase to mix it, all the fades are done with a fader, like with my fingers, because back then you didn't have digital consoles. Everything was, you know, you mix a song and you put 5 people in front of a console, and they oversee 5 channels each. And then, oh, the guitar is coming in, and a guy just does a performance. Every mix was a performance. And also, back then, MIDI was kind of like in its infancy. So nothing is really precise on time. So there is almost no quantization on the album. Everything is like played or, you know, moved around in a random way.
Yeah.
Just because the machines back then were not advanced enough to put everything, you know, the MIDI clock, which is what makes all the synthesizers go together.
Yeah.
It was very primitive. It didn't work as well as it does now. So it's all the devil's in the detail. It's all the little things here and there.
Yeah, I remember I started playing keyboards right around when it was, you know, the DX7. You know, it was like 87 in that era. So the digital synthesizers were the first. So I never actually owned an analog synthesizer myself. But right. I had friends who did. And I just remember going in and just, you know, with those faders and, you know, the knobs and the, you know, everything was just so much more fun, I thought, to be able to do it that way. And, you know, I understand that a lot of those synthesizers are just, they're out of commission now. You can't even, they don't even work anymore. So, I mean, I imagine it was kind of fun to do that sort of experimentation in a digital sort of setting to go backwards with that technology, you know, to make it like it's not just this out of the box sound that I'm just going to use. So, you know, for me, I don't know what it was like for you, but it would just be so much fun to just experiment to try to relive those moments of youth.
Here's the thing. I'm old because I'm 42 now.
Right. Well, I'm older than you. I'll be 45 next month, so I'm even older.
Oh, 45 is the new 43.
There you
right.
go, yeah.
I grew up in the era of the big albums of the past, you know, the classic albums. So I'm in love with all the lore of just going into a studio and then... everything was, you know, you had one synthesizer for one thing. You know, now we have pieces of machinery which are like a slab of plastic and they make 2,000 different sounds. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the past, you had this kind of like, almost was almost like a voodoo thing that you use the Fender Rhodes or the CP80. You know, you had those machines, mm-hmm. or the OB2, and it had that sound. It was like, I wanna go back and get all my favorite sounds from the past and then put them in here and there just for myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so it's like, oh, you know, that's the synthesizer, you know, the Toto synthesizer from Africa, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. You talk a little bit about the films that inspired sort of the ideas behind this, you know, and I think of Giorgio Moroder and people like that. Were you imagining movie scenes when you were composing some of these tracks? I mean, what was kind of the mental process of it all?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. I would see what was interesting for me, because I do that as a living as a composer. I do write music to footage. So I don't know, for TV ads or stuff on the internet. I gave myself briefs like, so what's this supposed to look like? Mm-hmm. You know, you describe a thing. You know, there's a song called Water on Mars. It's because the main synth, it reminded me of, I think it was Leviathan. You know, it was, that must have been 1991.
Yeah, it was,
there was
a little
this
later,
like monster, yeah. Uh-huh. Which was made of water and looked like a snake.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
And that sound reminded me of that vibe. So yeah, I just imagine what it was, and you know, sometimes you work in a stream of consciousness, and sounds come out, and then you go, ah, so that's what it's like. Or some other times you go, okay, so this will be like a starship kind of moon kind of vibe. Let's use sounds that sound like that. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes you just want to, it's like an inside joke, you know, there's a song called Training to Be the Best, and the subtitle is Montage Music.
Well, I love that one, actually. That's one of my favorite ones.
It's that kind of soundtrack to a movie where the guy needs to learn to ski in like six hours. Street Fighter / you know, learning how to... I don't know, whatever. It was that kind of thing in the 80s where he's in love with her. She's the girlfriend of the dude who's really bad, but he's really good at skateboard.
Right.
And so the guy wants to get the girl, and you know, he becomes like a skateboard master in like 45 seconds, which completely destroyed my expectation of myself, because in the movies it was so easy. And I'm like, oh my God, I cannot do this. Why?
Thank you. this is called Synchestral Works Volume 1. That implies there are going to be more releases along these lines. So is that something we can hope for? Yeah. I mean, I know you got other things going on, but I would love to see more of these. So please tell me.
In general, what happens with me and my output as a musician is that in the past, I tried to control it and put stuff in boxes, but now I just learn to get what comes to me. You know, if in 3 weeks I decided to do this and it came out of me, the music came out of me this way, then I'm like, who am I to not let the music be? You know, and then if it's got a place for everybody to enjoy, then everybody will be happier. I don't know.
Yeah. Do you think this has found an audience yet, or are you trying to get it to find an audience? Is there feedback coming in from people like me who have this?
Everybody's really happy. And also, there is a scene that's called the synthwave scene, which is pretty much the old vaporwave scene, which is pretty much a new thing where you have new bands that are taking the 80s vibes and then writing new songs in style. And it's quite of a big deal now. So it's kind of like the right time. On the album, there is the last song on the album that's actually, there is this band I play bass for on a song. The band is called Glitter Wolf. And they have an album called Spectrum. And what they do is this, it's called Synthwave, which is writing pop songs in the vibe of Depeche Mode or, you know, even like something more AOR-ish like, you know, Foreigner or, you know, all the good stuff from the 80s with big synthesizers. When I wrote the album, I thought this is going to be an instrumental album. And but 5 days, 6 days, sorry, 6 days before the deadline, I thought, well, in the 80s, to sell a soundtrack album, they would get a pop star from the, you know, from you know, a top 10 pop star, write a song for the pop star, and then that would be the thing that trails the sales of the album, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, Brian Ferry. Yeah,
you go watch Top Gun, and you go, Highway to the Danger, you know, that kind of stuff. So the whole thing would be an instrument, well, an orchestral or synchestral job, but you would have one radio single. Right. So I thought, well, why don't we do that too? Because, you know, I'm mates with the guys in Glitter Wolf, and, you know, the Mike, who's the singer in the band, he's got the perfect voice for it. So I called and I said, do you want to do this? And they're like, yeah, let's do it. So in the song Risen in the Black, which is the last song on the album, it just came out of me in like half an hour. I just did like quick arrangement for it. So I sent out the stems for them to work on. And Mike, he rewrote the verses in the middle eight, and he wrote all the lyrics. And it was, everything was very quick. And then I asked a friend of mine who's an Italian guitar player called Stefano Ragni, to play the solo. And I said, just make it really 80s. This is like an inside joke that we want to do. And everything came together, and it sounded like Ozzy Osbourne, you know, the Ultimate Scene album.
Yeah.
Do you remember that? And he's got that kind of vibe. It's a bit Michael Jackson, is a bit Beat It. And it just came together, and that's one of my favorite things on the album, because there's a lot of friends who came together and worked on it, and I'm really proud of it.
Yeah, it's such a nostalgia trip to do these, to listen to these tracks. And it's good for me to hear that it wasn't all that difficult to get into this sort of a retro feel for things, because I imagine as someone who's been actively composing, like you're constantly doing that, but in more of a contemporary, you know, what's happening now sort of vibe, as much as, you know, prog can be that. I know that's some of what you do. But that it's good that you can get back into that sort of a feeling, and it's not a struggle. You know what I mean?
It's actually, that's less of a struggle than write something new. Because as a grown-up, you know, the music for everybody. You know, I don't remember. I read this thing on a website that the music that defines you is what was around when you were 14.
Yeah, I saw that too. Mm-hmm.
Up to when you're like 24, 25.
Yeah.
And that's because that music is connected to the experiences that make you the man you are.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just you listen to a song and it's a cool melody, but you listen to a song, it's a cool melody, and I remember that summertime.
Right.
Or I remember that movie.
Oh, yeah.
So it's, as I said, that vocabulary of the sense of that specific melodic writing, of that specific aesthetic, is entrenched inside my musical being, you know. And, you know, all I had to do is just tap into it, and it was very simple.
Where do people get a copy of it? Let's relive the 80s a little bit now.
Because it was okay, so, yes, well, there's a website, which is... you can either get it from the Bad Elephant website, or there's a Bandcamp website, which is nostromoproject.bandcamp.com.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you can get the album. And also what I'm trying to do now is to try and see if I can put it on vinyl too, because I would love to do that. And because that's, you know, that's proper, isn't it?
It's like, the perfect thing for that. Yeah, all analog sound. Yes, that's great.
Yeah, I mean, on blue vinyl.
Blue vinyl,
blue,
yeah.
Vinyl, if I can. there is this website called Curates with a Q, and what they do is like crowdsourcing. You put together the vinyl project, and then you do a pre-sale of it, and if you get to 100 copies, they actually start producing it. So you pledge to buy the vinyl,
right?
And then when it gets to 100 copies, you can do it. The reason why I cannot just get to a place and say this is the album, just make me, like, you know, a bunch of vinyls, is because the cost to just start the vinyl production, you know, it's not worth it if you don't print at least 500.
Yeah, you gotta have the numbers. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, you can't, I can't, as an independent artist, I cannot do that.
Wouldn't it be fun if someone's listening who's a good video editor or animator or something like that, take some of this music and animate something to it? Wouldn't that be great?
Or I would be absolutely thrilled.
All right, that's your assignment.
Mystery person that you're listening, my music is out there. If you want me, my music to score, you to be the score of one of your creations, please, 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 please. I would be thrilled, please.
It's good stuff. Quickly, anything new on Rube Goldberg Machine Front you want to report?
We are working on a new album. We have new people in the band. We have new songs which are bigger, darker, longer, more progressive, better written, and... I don't know. I have finished the adjectives, but I am very proud to say we have written some of the finest music that we could ever write. It picks up from the old album, and it adds a lot of modern writing, and I just think they are better songs. You know, if you strip away all the arrangement, because I do so much writing for singers, for pop singers. I just want it to be, you know, like you listen to Toto and you go, that's, you know, they can play and they're like great musicians, but man, the hooks,
yep.
You know, and that's what I'm looking to achieve with the machine. It's like you have stuff that's interesting, which is kind of like, you know, what Stephen Wilson does as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he can write a song or 10, bless him. And then you just get awesome musicians and you just make it really interesting. That's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah. Looking forward to that as well, and more volumes.
It should be around October if all the planets align.
Excellent. All right. Well, I'll keep an eye on Bad Elephant for that, and you know, I'm sure you got your social media pages. We'll let us know that as well.
Yeah.
Anything else that I didn't talk about, either about this or anything else you got going on that you'd like to make sure people know about?
Do you know Tom Slatter?
Oh, of course. I've had Tom on the show.
Yeah. I with a couple of friends, I produced his last album.
Right.
Latest album, which was Happy People. No, he had another one in the middle, which was Murder in Parliament. But now he's working on a new album, which is going to be super interesting, and it's called Murder Ballads. It's an acoustic-ish album about people who kill people.
Yeah, that sounds very Tom Slatter-ish. So
that is very Tom Slatter-ish. he's such a cool dude to work with.
Jordan Brown, a.k.a. Nostromo. This is the album Synchestral Works, Volume 1. If you'd told me this was a Lost Tangerine Dream film soundtrack, Jordan, I would probably have believed you, and I know everything about Tangerine Dream, so, you know, you would have fooled me. So I'm really glad that this album's out there, and I'm really glad you joined the program again today, so thanks so much, and maybe I'll see you on the grid or in Fantasia or something like that. So.
I would like to thank you very much for the opportunity. It's a big honor for me to be here today and talking to you, and thank you so much for your attention and your time.
If you can find Bad Elephant Music online or on Bandcamp, you'll find this album. $5 is the asking price for a download currently, so I think it's a bargain at 3 times the price. So how about a full track from Synchestral Works Volume 1 now, and that way you can really get the feeling of it. It's hard for me to pick a favorite, but if I'm going with one that reminds me most of 80s soundtracks, aside from Training to Be the Best, which you heard a bit from earlier, it's probably track number 5 out of 9. If you've heard enough of those 80s soundtracks, you'll have heard tunes like this, but Jordan makes it an homage, not a parody. Here's Love Theme. Thank you. Now, let's talk business. The music streaming business, that is. As I've said on this show before, I'm not much of a fan of Spotify. Really don't like it, as a matter of fact. Yes, it's convenient for playing all sorts of music and discovering new artists, but the man I spoke to for this next segment is a big reason why I avoid it. The primary reason, actually. Anil Prasad has been interviewing artists in prog, jazz, fusion, classical, and many other related realms for more than two decades now, and his website innerviews.org, that's innerviews.org, that was the first of its kind in the early days of the World Wide Web. He was first, folks. He's also author of the best-selling book Innerviews, Music Without Borders, and it's safe to say that I respect his outlook on topics that relate to musicians and the world they inhabit. So ever since Anil has made his, let's call them outspoken views about streaming services and the avarice of streaming companies known, and like I intimated there, he pulls no punches, I've learned quite a lot about how this is not an artist-friendly platform, and I've also learned why those same artists, especially the lesser-known ones, why they feel somewhat powerless to fight the pennies in royalties they're being paid per play. It's not even pennies per royalties, it's fractions of pennies. So without saying too much to start, I'll let Anil begin by telling you where he's coming from and why it's so vital to him that this message is heard by artists and consumers alike. It's a really important listen for anyone who wants to make sure they're doing all they can to compensate their favorite artists fairly. So please, have a listen to it.
Well, I come at it from the artist level. So I've interviewed a whole lot of people over time, hundreds and hundreds of artists. And I hear what they have to say about the state of things. So my perspective really is their perspective. I'm communicating what I think is a filtration of all of their opinions, their anger, their perspectives on what they're seeing, and then my own interactions with the music industry in various ways has also played a role in informing what I think. We've hit a fairly amazing point in history where artists are expected to essentially give their music away for free on all of the streaming services, the Spotify's, the Tidal's, the Apple Music's of the world. And it's nominally free. They get paid fractions of a fraction per play, per stream. It's essentially free. Right. And if you, I would encourage readers to simply Google streaming royalty payment statements, and they will see hundreds and hundreds of photos of musicians holding up their streaming, you know, royalties, and they're often in the pennies and the dollars. You know, the big joke is not enough to pay for a pizza or a six pack of beer. And for most of the musicians, I think that you write about, that you cover, I should say, and that I write about, they're experiencing record low payouts. Even in the progressive world, the jazz rock world, you know, the new music world, where historically they might have sold, you know, at the medium to high end, 2, 3, 5, 10, 20,000 physical copies of an album, or even downloads. They're seeing, you know, massively reduced amounts of compensation, you know, to, you know, 1/100th maybe of what they used to get. So there's that pressure. And on the other side, you know, it's almost like a vice grip. On one side, you have the industry demanding free. On the other side, you have consumers demanding free, expecting free, conditioned to believe everything should be free, which is really fascinating. And obviously, people point to this as an outgrowth of Napster, as an outgrowth of torrents and piracy. But, you know, that's only a part of the spectrum. It's also informed by corporate conditioning. It's informed by companies like Spotify and Apple and Google, who make enormous amounts of money on advertising, who make an enormous amount of money on ancillary things that they point people to, using music as simply a tool for that. So they're making tons of money. Spotify had an enormous IPO. The founder, Daniel Ek, is a billionaire. The front receptionist is probably a millionaire. The musicians are making nothing. Yeah. So we've got free on two sides, as I said, the vice grip, and we have the musicians in the center of it getting their heads squeezed. Yeah. And that is the reality of what we're seeing at the moment.
Yeah, and it makes me wonder, who's to blame for all of this? Because, you know, you could apportion blame. I mean, obviously the corporate side of it, we certainly see that. But, you know, you could make an excuse that, well, consumers are to blame for how this is happening because that expectation for free. But a lot of musicians just, I've heard them say it, well, it's what we got to do now. It's just the way things are, so we have to do it. I mean,
well, I'm not sure blame is the word I would use. I would say there's sort of a tacit acceptance or acquiescence. I mean, musicians, let's face it, have never been ones to really effectively organize. At the end of the day, there is no music industry without musicians. I feel musicians tend to forget this reality. And, you know, this has been going on for years and years talking about streaming compensation. I mean, if the majority of musicians were willing to take a stand and organize, they could actually fundamentally shift the power here. I mean, we saw how one megastar, like a Taylor Swift, could shift, you know, Apple's view on certain things. And of course, she, you know, went back and put all their stuff up there anyway and sort of went back to playing that game. But really, it's, you know, musicians are so focused on survival, creativity, building their own audience. It's a real struggle for them, and for them to look beyond that and look at the wider world of what the acceptance of being on these systems means. I realize that's extremely difficult. I mean, if you want to use the word blame, I do think musicians should understand that when they do participate on these streaming systems willingly, not questioning the fractional payouts, they are empowering these services to further manipulate them. I do think they need to make their opinions known. I do think they need to communicate with the services, and in aggregate, I would like to see more writing from musicians. There's an amazingly fantastic cellist named Zoe Keating, who kind of intersects with the art and art rock worlds to a certain degree, mm-hmm. who's said a lot about this topic. I think there's some strategies that musicians can focus on. We can talk about that if you'd like as well, to sort of make this more survivable. Really, it's a whole ecosystem of acquiescence from consumers to musicians to labels to management. And at the end of the day, I do feel they're all being played by the Apples, Spotify's, and Tidals of the world.
Well, you know, there is that expectation, you know, I can just go to YouTube and listen for free. And we as listeners really have to assess how we do this to make sure that we have the music still coming our way that we want to come our way. Because honestly, looking at it as someone who used to create music before all of this stuff was going on, I would never want to do it now just because, yes, it would be great to get my work out there. And I'm sure that's the motivation for most, if not all, of the musicians in the realms that you and I talk about. But it's like, it just seems like it's a loser's game all around. Like, you really need to know what you're getting into as a musician. if it's great if you just want your work to get out there, and if that's all you're in it for, it's fine. But as a money-making prospect, I don't know why anybody would do it these days, because it's almost impossible, it seems to me.
Well, I think one of the things the streaming services take advantage of is the fact that they know musicians, real musicians, need to be musicians. They're going to be creative. They're going to want to make art and get it out there. It's a compulsive instinct. Real musicians just simply need to be who they are. So, in terms of the monetization component of it, it has never been more difficult or more complex than at this moment in time. The monumental understatement. Yeah. I know a lot of musicians, including major name brand musicians, who no longer can make a living from their recordings. I mean, I know so many major jazz musicians that are making more money teaching than from their recordings. You know, one of the great comic things as a fan to watch is when you go up to the merch booth and you see no recordings and you see, you know, mugs and scarves, gardening kits,
flamethrowers,
sunglasses. I mean, like, basically they're selling anything but a recording these days, and vinyl records, of course. And we can talk about that bizarre reemergence as well, if you'd like. But you have to look elsewhere for that income as a musician. I do talk about this sometimes, particularly in social media. I do believe there is a small, addressable market of responsible, cognizant music purchasers that still want to either own a physical item or contribute to a musician's well-being. I do believe musicians need to find these people, harness them, speak to them. Another point to make about, you know, when I said musicians are being played by the streaming services, I mean, I had a post on Facebook recently where I said, I just want one single musician to come forward and tell me that streaming and the offering of free music is working for them in any way, shape, or form. Not a single person came forward to say that this is working for them. And hundreds of musicians follow me, including a lot of very, very serious musicians, like really important ones in the progressive new music, art rock, jazz rock worlds. Not one, not a single one. But they're also afraid to say it's not working because they don't want to appear to be A, out of touch, B, risk retaliatory impacts from some of the streaming services, and C, just look uncool.
Yeah.
I think listeners might be surprised to learn that some of these streaming services are very vindictive, retaliatory against the musicians. They coerce them into participating. They send out, you know, little, you know, horrible emails to them, threatening them. It's incredible. I mean, I don't think that side has really been exposed in any kind of significant way. And I'm not going to mention the services who are doing that because I don't want to be sued.
Right.
But I assure you this is happening in the background.
Yeah. It's you're mentioning some of the people that are the reasons why they might not want to talk about this. But there are some people who have been holdouts, at least for a while, the musicians, I mean, for putting their work on Spotify or the streaming services. But it's like every once in a while you'll kind of quietly hear, you know, here's a Steven Wilson going to put his stuff out there. And they just kind of quietly, you know, do it. And it's just, there's no outcry. It's like, oh, great, you know, great, I can get that music on Spotify now. Or it's not, you know, something that is really seen as a good thing to be a holdout necessarily. Do you think that it's wise for someone to be a holdout, to be like an outsider? Does that give them any sort of cachet maybe with their audience? Is it good, or is it going to be self-defeating in the end because this is kind of an inevitable development, the whole streaming thing?
Well, I mean, it's not even an inevitable development. It is what it is. It is the predominant form of consuming music today. Is there any cachet in being a holdout? Probably not anymore. Is there any cachet in maybe not putting everything on streaming? Maybe that's a concept some musicians need to think about. I think Richard Barbieri, you know, of Japan and Porcupine Tree fame, is a very interesting example of that, where he will only put up a sampler of his music on Spotify. It's a great sampler. It's like some of his very best music, actually. Mm-hmm. But he's not giving away the farm. His view is, I'm going to put up, you know, a select number of tracks, and if people want to learn more, they're going to have to find me. They're going to have to actually type my name into Google, learn more, and see where they can, get more of this great music from. Mm-hmm. I think you can use these services intelligently. I find it fascinating that, you know, some of these major labels put these like $200 box sets up on streaming simultaneously with the physical item being available in stores. It's like, talk about shooting yourself in the foot. But I mean, that also comes down to the complexities of the labels also being investors in Spotify. And that would take an hour just to explain that issue right then and there. But I do think what musicians need to do is make their voices heard, explain their dissatisfaction, take it all the way to the federal government level. Streaming is unregulated. Musicians are not told what they are going to be paid until they are paid. The conditions, you know, of business are not articulated. I don't know what other industry that could really occur in. Imagine, taking a job and having the boss say, well, welcome aboard. And you ask, well, how much am I going to get paid? And they say, don't know. You'll have to find out when you get your paycheck. I mean, that's how it works. It's a black box. The royalty methodology is not explained to musicians. The payouts are not explained. Nothing is told to them. And how can that be allowable when it's the predominant method for music consumption these days? So I do think musicians have to tell people, we're not happy. We will contemplate withholding our music. We expect, more from you, especially Spotify, this incredibly multi-billion-dollar enriched post-IPO company is still paying out crap. Mm-hmm. How can they do that? Where's all your money going?
Mm-hmm. Right.
They're getting away with it because they can get away with it and because there is no resistance.
Mm-hmm. Do you see that ever being organized, though? I mean, it's going to take... I guess in the days back with Napster, it seemed like it was Metallica. You know, they were the ones that kind of led the charge on that whole thing, the free pirating, streaming, that sort of way of doing it. But what's it going to take? I mean, like, is there a critical mass that you think, or like critical people like the Taylor Swifts that are going to have to bring that process to get it started?
Well, I mean, history and countries are littered with failed musician unions.
Oh, yes.
going back into the 50s and 60s, frankly, certainly the United States is not a particularly union-friendly country anymore either. Mm. So I don't think it's kind of an MU, as they say, a musicians union focus. I do think if key superstars or, standard bearers in music made their voices heard, I think that would be valuable. They're told not to make their voices heard. Their management tells them, you don't want to look uncool. You don't want to look like you're not with the times. And really, I mean, this is the way the conversation gets framed by industry and management. Don't look uncool. Don't look like you're out of touch. This is not about being uncool. This is not about being out of touch. This is not about being a Luddite or anti-technology. Streaming is the way it is. It just needs to change. The compensation model needs to change. I also encourage musicians who are very resistant to this idea to spend 2 or 3 minutes during every one of your live shows and go, hey, look, here's what's going on. Here's the reality we're facing. Here's how you can help. If you enjoy this music, if this means something to you, if it enriches your life, consider buying a recording. Consider actually paying for something. If you don't want to buy a recording, support us in some other way. Buy something from the merch stand. Just make a random donation, even if you want to. These aren't pie-in-the-sky ideas. I mean, when I bring up stuff like this, people like call me a communist, which I think is hilarious, particularly in the current context.
In Trump's America, yeah.
I don't know how, supporting the arts became communist.
Right.
But spend a few minutes doing that. Most musicians resist this. They think it makes them look weak. They don't want to do anything but project success to their audiences. And I think that is a massive mistake because you are just perpetuating the lies that are being propagated. I saw Billy Cobham recently, the great jazz rock legendary drummer from Mahavishnu Orchestra and so many other projects. He did that. He spent like 4 minutes on stage. It was Billy Cobham in a sold out house going, look, everyone. This is what's happening with us, okay? You love this music. Here's what you can do to help. You need to understand, the lies you have been fed out there. He didn't actually quite put it that way, but he certainly intimated that. Mm-hmm. And he did it with humor. He did it with fun. People were laughing, and there was a huge line at the merch table after. So that's just a tiny, teeny, you know, example of something people can do.
Mm-hmm. Some other strategies. Is it maybe like you bring up vinyl earlier? Is it trying to find the niche market? Is that kind of a strategy you think that some of the people, at least sort of on the fringes, like, you know, our folks that we tend to like, is that the way to go? I mean, I definitely get what you're saying about reaching out straight to the consumer, whether it's at the live shows or whatever, but it doesn't necessarily have to be vinyl, but, you know, some of those physical media folks, like myself, I try to be as much as I can anyway. Is that a way to go, do you think, or has that ship kind of sailed?
Oh, that ship has definitely not sailed. That niche market is definitely there. And, you know, when I talk about the small addressable consumer market, that is the one. And it's a lot of it is vinyl. It's deluxe edition CDs. It's, you know, I mentioned Richard Barbieri. You know, other people will just put the core album on streaming. But if you buy the physical deluxe package, there'll be a second disc of rarities, remixes, demos, whatever it is. It's about making that physical item have value beyond whatever may be out there in free world on streaming. Vinyl is very complicated because it is so expensive to manufacture. Mm-hmm. In this day and age, there's very few old school, you know, vinyl mastering engineers or people who know how to cut vinyl with any kind of talent anymore. Again, that's another 2-hour show for you. the complexities of the current vinyl era. But yeah, I mean, artists can typically get that stuff manufactured for between $16 and $22 and turn around and sell it for $30, $35, $40. And that can be a profit center, certainly, for them. And whatever it takes, actually. I do find vinyl slightly bizarre because it's such a compromised listening experience, at least in my opinion. I see musicians putting out stuff only on vinyl, as well as retaliation against streaming. Yeah. You know, where there is no digital equivalent, they will not actually even put out files of content. It'll just exist on vinyl. Very interesting. You know, something. That's kind of a retrograde throwback, really? But there you go.
Well, there's a band, I'm going to play one of their songs toward the end of the show, but I kind of wanted to get your input on this strategy. It's sort of they're trying to use the streaming services to their advantage as much as they can as a small, like, unknown band. They released singles. Like, they don't have an actual album. They're not releasing physical media, but, you know, like every 3 months or so they've been releasing a single. And with this most recent one, they took it straight to the fans and said, hey, we want to try to get to 20,000 plays on Spotify. And for a band like us, that's really difficult, but that seems to be some sort of a magic number. I don't know, for, you know, some sort of like bigger interest from labels or things like that. So what they actually asked to do is say, if you have Spotify, you know, on your computers or whatever, just put this on loop and just loop it all day. And it's a 5-minute long song and you can play it a few hundred times a day and we'll boost those numbers up. But they made that a social media thing. Like, they went out and did it, and they've been getting about a couple thousand hits or plays a day. So I'm curious if you think that that's a good strategy. Do you think it's going to have any sort of impact on what their future prospects might be?
So, I mean, people hilariously point to me as someone being out of touch with how things work, and I certainly am not. And I am aware that the tonnage of streaming plays now influences a lot. It influences modern promoters, not old school promoters, you know, booking agents, you know, labels, they pay attention to this stuff. You know, the American talk show hosts, the Jimmy Kimmels of the world, now base their booking policies on streaming traction. That's how it works. So it depends on what a band wants out of life, you know, what it's trying to achieve and accomplish. If the goal is the pie-in-the-sky breakthrough of some kind, you know, there's a shot, I suppose. I mean, I don't see a star-making machinery element to streaming that the streaming companies would like you to believe exists. I think it's a giant crapshoot, just as it always has been. Mm-hmm. And it's maybe even more of a crapshoot than ever, because there are so many musicians, so many projects, no barriers to distribution, but certainly barriers to cutting through the din, you know, to get people to actually listen to what you do. So, the streaming auto looping thing, I mean, there's so many strategies to manipulate streaming numbers in your favor. I say, why not? You know, if you can get something good out of these horrifying companies, you know, that benefits your band, then sure. You know, they're working the system the way that they see fit, and I certainly see nothing wrong with it.
All right. Well, I'll report back maybe in a later episode about it and see what what comes from that. Well, if there are any other folks out here who aren't familiar with what you do, you know, your journalistic pursuits, I want to make sure that they can get a chance to follow you and read your articles and interviews, because they're very, very well written, very fascinating. A lot of great artists that overlap with what we do on Progtopia. So can you give us like a website or just however you want people to follow you?
Sure. I think the best place to go is interviews, the website, interviews.org, INNERVIEWS, and certainly a whole lot of prog rock on there. So please have a look, and there's also links to social media stuff there too.
Final thought, do you think that this is going to change anytime soon? Or do you see any hope on the horizon at all?
No. I do not see much hope on the horizon at all, to be completely honest.
That's
with
what
you.
We want.
What I do think it is about individual artists at this point telling people what the conditions of their environment are, communicating with their audiences directly, telling audiences how they can play a role in sustaining their careers and the creation of creative music. I think that's where we are at the moment. I think it is also, I mean, if musicians could get their act together and could let people at the highest levels of government, understand that this needs regulatory oversight, and that there's even a taxation issue associated with it that could benefit the government, I think that's another route that this can go. The companies are going to do nothing. Absolutely nothing to help the musician community. Never going to happen.
Yeah. No,
so the future of this truly resides in the hands of the musicians themselves.
All right. So, folks, we've been listening to my interview with Anil Prasad of Interviews. He's a great follow on social media. Just, you know, be prepared. There's a lot of opinions that if you're of a certain bent, you may not like. but he's totally unapologetic about it. And, I really enjoy reading everything that Anil puts out. So I appreciate you sharing your considerable insights on this. I mean, you got a lot more of your fingers on the pulse more than mine is. So thanks for enlightening me and hopefully enlightening the rest of the audience. I appreciate it.
Great. Thank you for having me on.
Finally, for this episode, the most recent single from a band that I profiled at the end of 2017 in episode 120. It's one I also gave my Best Newcomer Award for 2017 too. I Am Warface is an electro-rock five-piece from the UK who, as I said, and as singer-songwriter Matt Warnford mentioned in that episode, they're going the route of releasing digital singles every few months rather than a full album. Along with their frequent live gigs this summer, this is part of an audience-building strategy that they're hoping bears fruit in greater exposure and label interest. They've already got Gary Newman's endorsement, which is nothing small, and now with their most recent single, Closer, released on July 13th, they're asking fans on social media to loop the song on Spotify to boost the numbers and hopefully get the attention of those who make the big decisions in the music world when they look at those numbers of plays on streaming platforms. As I record this, I know that they were above 10,000 with it and probably approaching 15,000. So we'll see how it goes. And, you know, even though this band isn't within the classic definitions of prog for some folks maybe who are even listening to this, for me, like a Neil when it comes to sharing his opinions and his writings, I make no apologies for stretching what that nebulous term prog means. I don't even care if they're prog. I like their music. I Am Warface is making challenging but infectious music that I believe is going to get them somewhere, but it's clear that fan involvement on a very visible level is crucial to that these days. So, I present to you now the full version of the song I gave a teaser of back in December, Closer.
Hope you liked what you heard.
And if you did, and if you want to contribute to boosting those Spotify numbers, look them up on that platform. I'm willing to for this purpose. Make sure you have their name spelled right. It's all one word. I am Warface. And while you can find a lyric video for Closer on YouTube as I record this, on July the 27th, the actual video will be released. I caught a sneak peek of it, and it's very well matched to the dark nature of the music. It's black and white, it's alternately flowingly beautiful and angst-filled, just like the song is. So please check it out. I do believe in these guys. They've got something, and I think if it finds the right audience, they're going to break out. And with that, we close another episode. But not before, I thank Jordan Brown, Anil Prasad, and Matt Warnford for their contributions once again. Don't forget to find Anil at innerviews.org, innerviews.org. You will have plenty of excellent reading material, I promise, so devote some time when you go there. Progtopia's theme music is from the Salvation Song Suite by Galahad, from their 2012 album Beyond the Realms of Euphoria, used with permission. A little more from Nostromo's Synchestral Works Volume 1 to play us out. It's The Hero We Need. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time in a land called Progtopia.